The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We give voice to those who challenge a prevailing sentiment in global financial markets. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. Guests were not compensated for their appearance, nor do they supply payment in order to appear. Individuals on this podcast may hold positions in the securities that are discussed. Listeners are urged to educate themselves and make their own decisions. Now, here's your host, Mr. Nathaniel E. Baker.
Chris Nicholson, independent portfolio manager based here in New York. You have a long career, most recently at the hedge fund Iron Harbor Capital, and you have a pretty broad cross-disciplinary look at assets and geographies. You did a stint in China, I know.
Right.
Which I think is valuable now in the present day, considering all the volatility that we've seen and, you know, everything that's happened just from the COVID crisis alone. But there are other broad forces at work. So maybe we could just start and just for you to get your views on the market, on economies, and how you see things.
Sure. I mean, it's a very tough time for forecasters of all biases and capabilities, as you know, COVID has really dominated the landscape. Obviously, sort of forecasting interest rates and, you know, exactly how far into the future we get away from impressively real negative rates has actually been vexing to people for a while, maybe as far back as 2012, you know, pretty consistently, right? We had the taper tantrum. We had, you know, the more recent taper that started to unwind reasonably before COVID-19. And then, you know, that really produced a lot of volatility in the markets. And of course, you know, the markets are prepared for a decent amount of volatility. If you look at some of the implied vol numbers, it tells you people are paying up big for put options on a wide array of assets, right? Implied vol in oil was well into the triple digits up until recently, and we've seen a lot of choppy price action just in the last few days there. And these things trickle across assets. You know, I think the U.S. market is generally dominated by kind of equity thinkers and sort of U.S. focused thinkers that, based on their own experience, have meant to think that the U.S. was reasonably decoupled from the global picture. And investors here, which, you know, dominate the kind of marginal pricing in a lot of global markets, have been slowly coming around to the view that, well, you know, global markets maybe really matter. And, you know, they're the marginal contributor to demand or lack thereof, inflation or lack thereof. And it's really those two factors that I pay a lot of attention to determine where the money flow is going to go. And so I think of, you know, U.S. equity prices on kind of two axes, one related to equity prices elsewhere and what could be, you know, a near-term shift in appeal across geographies, and U.S. equity prices relative to U.S. bond prices and commodities as sort of the major asset classes.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because this whole – everything is so Fed-driven. At least that's what we would perceive here in the U.S.
Right.
And to point – and we had this rally dating to March 23rd, which was very much a Fed-driven rally. But you're saying now that the other forces internationally are at least as powerful, if not more so?
Yeah, well, maybe two key points, you know, where you highlight kind of Fed-driven markets as maybe somewhat of a broad consensus opinion that's, again, lasted for quite a while generally. And for equity investors, I guess that rubs up against an equity investor's sense of, well, what is kind of a fair forward PE? And is there something, you know, durable for all time about that? Maybe you look at a Shiller PE even to adjust for cyclicality. But, you know, I guess the financial theorist would say, well, you have to look at the fair forward PE in the context of interest rates and what the at least sort of medium to longer term real interest rate landscape is going to look like. That's kind of an uncomfortable idea, I think, for equity investors generally. And so, you know, people look to the Fed to set interest rates.
Right.
If you're going to be, you know, sort of an active money manager and try to charge more than the passive indexes charge and provide more value than the passive indexes charge, you have to anticipate Fed moves and, you know, think like a central banker in some ways, sort of outwit the central bankers in some ways. And, you know, they don't like to be sort of front run, and they burn investors really badly sometimes when they try to do that. But actually the Fed has to respond to the global economy. And at the end of the day, it's important to think of interest rates as sort of the remainder of supply and demand for capital. So, you know, if the projects and activity don't soak up the amount of capital that's available, whether it be for demographic reasons or otherwise, maybe, you know, political gridlock reasons, not letting that capital get to work, then you're going to have low interest rates. And I guess another factor that quickly drops out of that is what's the right number for inflation and how do you anticipate that? So that's a place I've found I've been able to add some real value in the last 8 years or so, in that I think investors always looked at inflation in the U.S. as kind of a 2% or so baseline, at least since it got, you know, more under control in the 90s, you know, due to NAFTA, due to globalization, due to whatever government policies that, you know, may in some ways be controversial, very controversial policies, maybe leading up to the 2016 election through here. But, you know, 2% inflation is not a given. And we've seen that. And the risk to the upside that most investors have focused on is not a given. So that means, you know, bonds that are relatively safe, yielding 2% and change, can be very attractive sometimes, especially if you've got some duration on it. You know, just stretching a little bit in terms of a PE, if you have maybe sort of medium quality bonds, corporate bonds or something, yielding on a 3 handle that are sort of durably attractive enough, you know, maybe your forward PEs start to creep up into the high 20s at least, such that the reciprocal is, you know, sort of a somewhat of a risk premium, but modest enough. And as you mix them in your risk parity portfolios, you know, everything nets out. But so I've tried to look at inflation by seeing, well, what's the demand for money? What's the creation for money? Not on the monetary base and central bank buying, but, you know, those fractional reserves getting recycled at the private banks. Okay. And, you know, other types of financialization. That's really what creates money more so than the central banks and the monetary base.
That's assuming that the central bank is in line with the demands of the private sector, I guess, right? And there have been...
Right. I mean, it, in as much as their policy goals are generally, you know, inflation and employment, depending on the central bank, they have to be, you know, reasonably in line with supply and demand, or they kind of cause a recession or sort of let unused labor productivity basically spoil on the shelf in a way.
Yeah.
You know, or kind of lose credibility and, right. and, you know, sort of demonetize, if you will. Mm-hmm. But that means then that the U.S. central bank needs to be enough in line with the rest of the world economy. And I guess another factor that, you know, for investors that trained maybe 80s, 90s, 2000s, we had a fairly weak dollar for a lot of that period. We spent a lot of money on foreign wars, you know, other things. I mean, even going back to sort of the Cold War era. And, you know, we've had a relatively strong dollar in the last 8 years or so. And even though we have a significant trade deficit, we're a bit more competitive and higher growth economy than the other large economies, large developed economies, at least worldwide. And I guess the last factor I'd put in there is, you know, China was growing like crazy for years and years, even as it got to be a pretty large economy on the global landscape. And, you know, it's hit more natural limits. And people were really vexed by, you know, how can China grow what's somewhat of a command economy? You know, how can they grow it so quickly and so durably? And there are some good reasons where if you have really talented people at the top, you might be able to grow a command economy very quickly if you're a fairly low income economy. And then right. as you get toward middle income and beyond, things get a lot more challenging. And we've sort of seen that, you know, seen that adjustment in China. And again, that, mm-hmm. you know, that hurts the demand for capital globally and dampens interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, covered a few, you know, broad yeah. spots there, but,
yeah, I don't really know which one I want to pick on first. I mean, maybe let's go to the inflation and the fact that you say that the demand for money. I mean, right now, one would think there is a lot of demand for capital from mm-hmm. the businesses that have been hit, right, with whose financings, you know, they're just, they've been in trouble here because they haven't had the receipts for a couple of months now. Many of them, not all, but many of these economies in the U.S., and it's not just the U.S., by the way, this has been a global thing, of course. So one would think that the demand for capital is pretty robust, or maybe even beyond that, and that therefore it's
yeah.
prudent for the central banks to keep
the spigots
on. Yeah. So what yeah. does one do there? So that it looks like then that alone would speak to more inflation in the future, right? Or is it the other way around?
Yeah. Well, you have to sort of spread this effect from, you know, 2020 forward a right. bit. And if there's sort of an anticipated contraction in demand for capital later on as sort of somebody pays back those loans, that gets factored in somewhat and you have kind of a smoothing of the inflation. Yes, maybe you do have, you know, sort of a short-term pop that quickly peters out due to sort of base effects, in part, right? Your
sure.
price level maybe creeps up a little bit, but then, you know, that prices out maybe portions of the economy, portions of the labor market, they're stale. You have some slowdown and there's, you know, reversion to that underlying trend of inflation. I mean, you know, there's a political process just to satiate that demand for short-term capital for companies and, you know, passing through to their employees to keep everyone afloat here, right?
Right.
And, you know, I think there was an interesting moment in the sort of healing from the global financial crisis where strong growth, maybe inappropriately strong growth leading up to the financial crisis had crept up the price level and, you know, sticky prices caused a painfully slow readjustment to, you know, 2008, 2009 demand forward. And, you know, you had the European debt crisis lingering through into 2012 and, you know, what some might call sort of German austerity dominating that question all the way until maybe just very recently, or, you know, at least partially here forth, which, you know, which put a damper on demand in the wake of that. But in that period, I think Ben Bernanke, you know, in his wisdom gains from his studies in the of the Great Depression, mm-hmm. said, hey, we have to support inflation from the bottom. And insufficient inflation is not a good thing, a really dangerous thing. It takes too long for the price level to adjust without sort of the nominal prices not taking care of that. And so you cut rates and you kind of pull forward demand in a way, and other central banks, you know, started to get on board with that idea, and maybe even somewhat haltingly, you know, fiscal stimulus to help with that was significant in places like China. You know, there might be controversy on this kind of statement, but, you know, maybe insufficient fiscal stimulus in the U.S., certainly insufficient fiscal stimulus in Europe. And, you know, other places don't have as easy access to capital as those places to sort of support the world economy. But, you know, QE, you know, buying of mortgage bonds, et cetera, you have to anticipate some of these, factors that are kind of coming from the Fed or coming from, you know, big movers in government that, you know, dictate markets.
Right. But you figure that all the central banks have got the religion by this point, right? You go back to 08 and Trichet famously raising rates there. Talk about it ill-timed, right? Mm-hmm. But since then, yeah. I mean, with the Draghi ECB and BOJ, you know, obviously in very much in inflation creation mode
yeah.
for a long time, the world's central banks seem to all be following this Bernanke playbook of, you know, throwing money out of helicopters, right?
Well, in part, I think okay. they're aware of sort of the technique and they're aware of the risk. But I think it was just a few years ago, Bernanke was sort of opining on the continuing lack of inflation in Japan and advising them, hey, maybe you need to really make a credible statement that you're going to issue unlimited bonds and unlimited stimulus until you get to, you know, the right inflation level. Mm-hmm. And, you know, folks have continued to put out what they thought were significant rounds of bond buying. And then they maybe moved to sort of yield curve control. They tried to stoke up their credibility and sort of unveil that much more about their projections and data to kind mm-hmm. of coax that inflation rate up while still having some worry that, gosh, are we going to go too far at some point and kind of lose credibility? Are we going to have, you know, a currency crisis with respect to other major currencies or what? So if you look at what the core inflation has been, or the headline inflation in kind of US, Europe, Japan as some majors, you have to look at China as something kind of on that dashboard too.
Sure.
You know, it's been pretty convincingly sub 2% in each of those three, particularly outside the US of those majors. And it continues to fall in China. So, you know, I just wouldn't say that they've gotten fully on board.
Okay.
And, you know, fully addressed the problem.
Okay.
And, you know, investors don't like low interest rates. A lot of folks want to, you know, make more money.
Sure.
No risk.
Mm-hmm.
But you find that, you know, that really tanks your economy. And at the end of the day, you know, we need people to be borrowing enough capital and sort of right. cyclically employing enough labor.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't choose high rates
mm-hmm.
in a vacuum.
Right. Okay. So if you're a currency trader now and you're looking at the world's major currencies, and obviously a lot of them are driven directly by central bank policy more than anything else. And again, you have, okay, so you have a few here that are not completely on board with the inflation or else mantra.
Do you think that those will come into line, like the BOJ being a big one, right? And do you think then that the trade is to short those currencies against, say, the dollar? Where does one go now as a currency trader, I guess, is the question.
Yeah. You know, stepping back and sort of talking frameworks and how I look at that problem, as you kind of lay it out, this is a big opportunity. If a lot of the market, you know, has one framework and not that many investors really do feel comfortable looking at currencies or looking at, you know, interest rates and inflation, but it certainly does affect, you know, equity prices, risk assets. There's another factor too that maybe I'll just put on the table briefly, but then aside here, which is commodity prices and oil prices specifically being such a huge factor in the commodity complex. What is a reasonable forecast for oil prices? That's a very big input to inflation. And, you know, over the shorter run, maybe looking at core inflation makes sense. But over the more medium term, depending on sort of different paths of oil prices, you really need to pay some attention to the headline inflation. So anyway, oil is a big factor, and I think maybe central banks have gotten their forecast on that wrong a bit. So then if you look at Japan, it's interesting. If you want to make money as an active money manager, you have to look at where is the market mispriced? Right. Why is it mispriced? Can I really track down the factors and assumptions that other folks have built into their models, if you will? And where's my catalyst?
Right.
When is my catalyst? Because, you know, there could be sort of other mini catalysts that take prices in the exact opposite direction of where you're betting. And that's painful. What's my number one recommendation for investors now and most of the time in terms of the best portfolio move? It's take the cheap borrow, right? You got a lever if money's coming at you at negative cost, but you have to be really sure that you put it a place where you're going to make back more in the future. And so that for me, I take a really close look at sort of the volatility and the, you know, kind of histogram and scenarios for the assets. And that is equal to more important than the return forecasts, you know, in the longer term. So people look at Japan and, you know, it's immediately synonymous with safe haven, right? So you don't want to be short Japan or short the yen, at least, coming into any kind of messy period. And, you know, you can have a really brilliant analysis, but then not really understand enough about, you know, virology, et cetera, and, you know, not have any real ability to anticipate there's going to be a new coronavirus popping up in the world, and you're going to be roasted on a yen short, you know, just coming into that kind of period.
Right.
Now, of course, you know, markets are reasonably liquid, and so you can get out of a bad move when it, you know, becomes so. And I'm not shy of having pretty tight stops on my trades. And, you know, per the title of your blog or sort of podcast blog and kind of professional sphere of competence, I don't want to be a contrarian in terms of the real money trading right now. I want to go with the flow, if you will, and not, you know, be complaining to folks about, hey, I'm losing money, but I know that I've got the right idea. Everybody's a price taker, you know, in that regard. I want to, you know, have some contrarian ideas about the future and act, you know, when assets are starting to act in my favor. So with regard to the yen, I like to play in the options. If something's not moving in your favor, but you know which direction it sort of has to go, then maybe you want to sell calls on the yen against the dollar and, you know, take some yield there and, you know, sort of have them kind of cash covered. You know, you could say naked, but it's really cash covered if, you know, your the rest of your portfolio risk isn't really too fully allocated. And if folks are really feeling risk averse and want to get coverage, they might pay you up pretty well for the calls you've written. Mm-hmm. But eventually, the sort of other side of that trade starts to be pretty attractive. And, you know, folks aren't paying up very much at all for puts. And that's what I found as this Bernanke idea sort of maybe slowly disseminated around the world. The yen was at about 75 to the dollar, and it kind of destroyed their corporate sector entirely. The whole Nikkei was trading at book value. You know, private companies obviously had to sort of implicitly take a discount to that, which meant, you know, nobody was rationally putting new money to work, milking every asset you could, right, for kind of cash flow. And so Japan had to do something about that. And you could buy puts on the yen sort of October 2012 for, you know, fractions of a percent per month kind of holding cost. Mm-hmm. And, you know, lo and behold, the Japanese Central Bank moved the next month to get the yen down in a big way.
Yeah.
So I do think in any kind of alleviation of the sort of global economic crisis at present, short yen is an interesting bet. And by the way, another thing that I think is almost as synonymous with Japan in a lot of people's minds is low margin companies. And so low margin companies that are exporters, right? Major export surplus there. And so if you have a cut to local labor prices, and that's basically what the currency is, mm-hmm. that's amazing margin boost for, you know, 1% and 2% margin exporters. Mm. And that's why you saw Japanese stocks rocket, I think, maybe 100% in the wake of the sort of yen cut late 2012.
Right.
Through the next, I don't know, 5 months or so. So, yeah, I think we might see a bit of a repeat of that scenario.
Hmm.
And, you know, it's an important thing to look at for global investors where we've gotten cheap money reflating our equity markets in the U.S. in particular, right? You know, people sort of looked at treasuries as another key safe haven. And they got frustrated with treasury rates. And you started to hear people rightfully talk about U.S. equities as the safe haven.
Yeah.
But I don't want to hold a safe haven when there's another good place to be. Hmm. And so, you know, just like in the taper tantrum, you could lose a lot of money holding a safe haven asset. If it's U.S. equities and Japan equities mm-hmm. start to look better. And I think a yuan weakening is also, you know, fairly close at hand. And obviously, you know, anytime you have neighboring large economies, they need to compete with each other. They need to trade with each other. And, you know, their currencies sort of diverging too much can be somewhat of a problem.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, weak yen and weak yuan are important themes I'm looking at. I think they're getting pretty close at hand.
You are listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We are on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and other platforms where podcasts are found. Subscribe and supply an honest rating. We are on social media. Search for Contrarian Investor Podcast on Twitter and Instagram. You can find us on LinkedIn as well. Go to linkedin.com/contrarianpodcast. We want to hear from our listeners. Email your thoughts to feedback@contrarianpod.com. A repository of all podcast episodes and materials is available on our website, contrarianpod.com. Now, back to the program. Here's Mr. Baker.
Wouldn't the weaker yuan
create a stronger yen, though.
Tell me more about, kind of your logic.
Well, because especially if the yen is a safe haven, right? Mm-hmm. And especially in that area, and the RMB is kind of the risk on trade, then if China starts getting into, the Chinese economy keeps slowing, or if they start creating more inflation from
what
the PCOB does,
yep.
Then investors go to the yen, right?
Yep.
So wouldn't that be what happens there?
Yeah, I think you're raising an important tactical issue that, and I haven't looked really closely at the weakening of the yen over just the last few, the weakening of the yuan, excuse me, over just the last few years to see its effect on the yen. I don't think they were really significant,
right?
But they probably were something that we all should have taken some note of. But I think that's really just a tactical issue where if the BOJ has to get the yen lower, they have to get the yen lower. Right. And if China makes it a little bit tougher in terms of global perception, they need to do something more aggressive and more credible. And if China starts to think, hey, maybe the yen is going to weaken and that's going to cause, a modest additional challenge for us, or Japan is thinking, hey, maybe the yuan is going to weaken and that's going to cause a modest or significant challenge for us going forward, we maybe want to get ahead of it. Or we maybe want to really, game it out and make sure we have the assets to, carry this out and be credible.
Mm-hmm. And what is the RMB now? I mean, it's been losing value, at least in dollar terms, for several years, right? I mean, going back to 2015 when China had the hiccups there in the middle of the year in their equity markets and they started, creating a looser monetary policy. So it's been, I haven't even looked, but it's been pretty significant.
Yeah. I mean, there were some pretty big reversals in there. China, of course, has a little bit more challenge than the developed nations in terms of kind of credibility on their, on their monetary moves. Although people have given them generally a decent amount of credibility and had, much more been looking for the yuan to be in kind of continual appreciation. And of course, they were looking for the Chinese economy as a whole to be in continual, high growth mode. And gosh, I feel like people have been saying for quite a while here, when global growth gets back to normal, which we're thinking of as sort of a pre-financial crisis, maybe number. Then that'll be China growth maybe back to normal, and will they be putting up 7 or 10%, annual growth again? And I think the answer is no, not in dollar terms.
Sure.
And that's kind of a permanent factor. So anyway, the yuan has been, kind of weakening at a general, maybe kind of, 5% annualized path of late, but with some pretty nasty hiccups, and they didn't want people to get too comfortable with that idea and anticipate.
True. All right. So we're looking globally here. You got equity markets in the US, which you seem to favor, but not as much as you favor equity markets in Japan. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, I mean, kind of reading between the lines, with me not maybe making that specific of a suggestion on the U.S., saying, rates are low. That's great for equities. Is U.S. More resilient to COVID interruptions and this being kind of a, many quarters disruption or more, or is it less resilient? I think I would say, sort of structurally, we're a more diverse economy kind of geographically than a lot of places. We're reasonably less densely populated kind of adjusted for where the GDP comes from. That's all good. We're relatively high income. That should be good, strong innovation sector, et cetera. But on a governance and political sort of effectiveness standpoint, we have not been so good. And that's, you know, that maybe dominated the investor narrative going through the recent dip here, but maybe there was a bit of excess complacency coming back to equity levels of, you know, 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, still you see those implied vols, maybe they were like high 20s 2 days ago, and they're like high 30s here. That's a really high number.
Yeah.
You know, the quants are certainly ready to bid that number way down,
mm-hmm.
On, you know, any real sign of sort of steady healing and the relative impossibility of sort of big announcements causing panic with regard mm-hmm. to kind of COVID and our measures to, sort of stay healthy and at work. And the quants know, hey, those low rates are there. I'm going in. But even though they see maybe kind of assured returns in the future, you know, they care about Sharpe ratio.
And yeah, of course,
they don't want to take too much volatility. So, you know, there's a little bit of a ping pong back and forth between some
of
those.
Of course. But it is interesting that you're thinking here, as you speak of safe havens and such, that there is very much in the calculus from portfolio managers like yourself appears to be a concern about a second wave of COVID, if not successive waves, not just this year, but maybe even next year. Do you think that's a fair statement?
Yeah. From what I know, getting a really effective vaccine for a respiratory virus is, not an easy thing to do. It seemed like the timelines of developing vaccines in general maybe has significantly shrunk before. I mean, monumentally shrunk from, you know, maybe 20 years to like, you know, 1 year or less here. But that doesn't mean that that vaccine is actually 100% effective. And, you know, people point to the flu vaccine in various seasons as a kind of endemic disease, and it's, you know, very dangerous for people in certain classes, but generally older and not too debilitating in the grand scheme of things, such that we're, you know, doing social distancing, et cetera. Certainly I could see, you know, seasonal mask wearing and stuff tick up quite a bit, in the US, but I think I'm optimistic that, the array of approaches we've taken to managing COVID-19 will limit the amount of disruption to the economy that we really get next season, let's say, if it becomes a more seasonal thing. You know, and the evolution of the virus sort of favors it becoming, of course, less deadly, or maybe even less supremely debilitating. I think technically what they mean is kind of continuation of the first wave, in areas outside of some of the hardest hit. And, yeah, I mean, there seems to be kind of insufficient seriousness of how some states are looking at controlling the spread. And, I mean, I'd never heard the phrase social distancing before however many weeks ago.
I call it anti-social distancing, by the way.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
A more appropriate description, but yeah.
Right. Right. I mean, there are definitely, you know, I think I'm an introvert. I love people and exchanging information, but I like to hide away a chunk. But it's not very human and natural to tuck away for long periods of time. And you know, a lot of us that don't have a family, you know, can't afford to go out to eat or drinks or do whatever. You know, we like to do that a lot. I mean, New York City, maybe stereotypically, we're doing it like 7 days a week. Yeah, our kitchen's too small. We don't have anything in the pantry. But, you know, even for folks that are used to a fairly different lifestyle, yeah, they get stir crazy and they go out and, you know, they don't necessarily do much of their own research. They catch snippets, and you know, government has a very powerful effect on their opinion of of, you know, the dangers and their kind of, you know, duty to society to try to slow the spread. you know, there's a free rider problem there. And I think sometimes people like to think, gosh, New York, like, that's a very different city. It's, you know, packed with people and they don't even really have cars. They're taking the subway. Like, they're paying crazy prices for really small apartments. Yeah, they have a much bigger problem with this COVID, but we'll be fine, you know, in this other area. And it's not the case with something that's contagious enough.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, long-winded answer somewhat to just say, in the very near term, it doesn't look like we have this thing fully under control. In terms of, you know, next winter and beyond in the Northern Hemisphere, I'm pretty optimistic it's not going to be that huge of a disruption.
Okay.
And I mean, let's say we did a great job with it in the U.S., but there were major problems in significant other parts of the world economy. U.S. stocks are not going to be in great shape because we have to trade with the rest of the world and, you know, can't just stand alone. So it's an issue we all have to track closely.
Yeah, yeah. Are there any other issues as you look forward here the rest of 2020? We have a certain little election coming up in November, I know. As far as other catalysts, potential catalysts that you are eyeing?
You know, just to reveal two other things that are kind of key to my process that I think are also, you know, particularly relevant of late. One, we started to talk about oil prices.
Right.
I think that there's been, you know, for a long period, a general investor rule of thumb without, you know, much ability to sort of derive the equation from first principles, that oil prices always go up, you know, maybe even more so than housing prices, you know, that we all thought through to the late 2000s. You know, the supply curve goes up generally. It, you know, gets harder and harder and more expensive to find more and more oil. Fracking put a big dent in that story. And, you know, renewables and kind of electrification of the auto fleet put a big dent in that story. Those things, of course, you know, going back to your thought about sort of short-term demand for capital and such, it doesn't need to be that electric cars are such a big share of the auto fleet or that renewables are so competitive right now to have a significant effect on oil prices right now, because OPEC, you know, the sort of oligopoly there, would like, of course, to have high oil prices, whether it be to, you know, balance their budget at a certain assumption based on the last plan, et cetera. And they've been able to do that successfully, you know, for decades. But they have to keep a lot of oil off the market sitting in their reserves, right? Artificial shortage to maintain the price.
Mm-hmm.
And if at some point in the future, the value of their reserves is going to go down, even though the current price maybe stays okay, they have to factor that in, right? Make the sort of intertemporal choice. And so, you know, many, many countries have 30 years of reserves proven, and their economy relies on oil being there, you know, for the long term. But if renewables and electrification of the fleet means that the sort of marginal price of energy trends to very low levels or zero 20 years from now, you know, those countries have to reevaluate their production decisions now and maybe try and sell more of that oil sooner. And so that's really taken some of the legs out of, I think, global inflation. And, you know, we talked a little bit about GDP and inflation as kind of two key factors determining prices and, you know, sort of all prices being relative. Lowering of inflation expectations almost always in the short term hurts equity prices and helps bond prices. And so, you know, an equity investor really wants to pay fairly close attention to the, you know, the implied prices there. Maybe look at, you know, playing inflation break evens as a hedge or playing oil as a hedge. So that's a big factor. And then the other factor I look at a lot is volatility and implied volatility. I know you've had some other guests that talked about implied volatility as kind of an interesting counter indicator of, you know, equity price risk. But, you know, I sort of look at options and think, well, if I buy the underlying, you know, I get all the upside and I accept all of the downside. But depending on what kind of fixed offer folks will give me to not accept any of the upside and just take the downside, I really have to compare that right to my decision to buy the underlying. And so when implied volatility is really high and I have a sense of the bounds of what the future might hold, you know, I really might prefer to be sort of selling options against that direction that I feel comfortable at. And if I can get really cheap options, low implied volatility, there's too much complacency out there in the market. And that's, you know, key to me rectifying what's really going to be true in the future. What do people think? I want to load up like crazy on options that I can buy for cheap because, you know, you can make tens of times your money on that and, you know, very little volatility. Zero downside risk beyond a certain level. So anyway, the commodity markets, oil markets tend to have really high implied volatility, kind of excess demand for hedging that, you know, not enough investors are willing to show up and accept that. So I look at that often as a place to make money. And I don't need a catalyst. I just need a I just need to avoid the sort of anti-catalyst that'll hurt me.
Right. How do you go about doing this if you're so options are simple enough. So you would have to get options on futures.
Options on futures, and you know, expiry works against you in the sense that you need to reset your options, and you know your correlations, everything maybe are always evolving. Yeah, so I can maybe make a bet on, okay, well, you know, shale's coming offline. Let me look at the rig count. What's the kind of minimum price that West Texas is going to be or Brent is going to be or the relationship between those in the, you know, 6-12 month period? Even when, if global demand is really lousy, but Saudi, Russia, et cetera, kind of try to collaborate to hold up a minimum price, I might be willing to sell puts, you know, at $30 a few months out and feel pretty good about that. And there are definitely a lot of oil holders that, you know, will pay me a lot to write those puts for them. They just, you know, they feel like they have to, even though it costs them a ton.
Although we have seen that Saudi-Russian collaboration is not something you necessarily want to bet against. It's no sure thing.
At least in the shorter term, right? Yeah. I mean, isn't that interesting? How long ago was it that they, you know, sort of made that collaboration to support prices? I feel like it was maybe, was that less than 2 weeks ago even that, we got the support? Maybe it was a little bit longer than that now.
Right.
But, you know, they make those announcements and it seems like they're definitely able to drive prices in the very short term, but they're not able to sustain it. If it's outside the kind of, you know, economically, equilibrium price. But you could also go out there and say, well, how many people are out there, you know, hedging their oil as an input cost? I mean, people use it for a million different things in the US, right? Autos, airlines, you know, a lot of investors just want to hedge inflation through oil and not see sort of all of the milk and honey go to the oil producers and that really hurt, kind of equity holders elsewhere. So, you know, what'll people pay me to write them a call option for oil at, you know, $55-$60 where I'm betting, hey, fracking is going to come back online. You know, Saudi and Russia actually might have pretty nice incentive to control the top end of oil. You know, so I'll take that perceived risk that I think is really not much of an actual risk at all and, take a rich premium on that side too. So that my, you know, my underlying beta to oil is more contained and kind of you know, sort of declines, kind of particularly in the middle of that spread.
Yeah.
So that's how I'll play it sometimes, but sometimes it'll be, you know, very directional. And in sort of a rel, val, vol world, you know, maybe long some, bond volatility, maybe long some currency volatility, equity volatility.
Now, how do you trade those?
I can buy back my risk so much cheaper, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, so it depends. I mean, like, obviously in equities, we have VIX futures.
Right.
And you can look at the whole curve, and there's some very interesting curve dynamics there that you can play. The asset itself, even if you are right about the general direction, is quite volatile, and you don't necessarily want to take too much of that idiosyncratic risk. It doesn't necessarily all get kind of diversified away in your balanced portfolio, if you will. But just by writing some options and then adjusting your beta with the underlying, you can kind of synthesize, you know, a vol play too. So, you know, that's the gist of it. And I think a lot of investors shy away from options because they think, well, you know, you got to be very precise and very quantitative. And it's really not that true. If you're going to be an investor, I think it pays to be comfortable with numbers reasonably. But we're really not talking about crunching a lot of calculations here.
Cool. Well, that's all very interesting, Chris Nicholson. Maybe in closing, you just tell listeners how they can find out more about you. I did see you have a Twitter account, I believe.
I do. I'm not more of a user of LinkedIn, so folks can definitely follow me there. I think I'm under Chris Nicholson, CFA, Chartered Financial Analyst.
Okay.
And certainly they'll see Iron Harbor in my background there. And then on Twitter, I think my handle is 2Christopher, number 2Christopher.
Okay.
So folks can certainly follow me there. And I'll just do my best to be visible if folks want to connect and challenge ideas or get my attention over.
Yeah, there is a very active, pretty active community, especially on Twitter. So I suspect you'll have people take you up on that offer.
Sounds great.
Very good. Thanks so much again, Chris, for joining us, and we look forward to speaking to you all again next time.
Thank you for listening to the Contrarian Investor Podcast. We hope you enjoyed this episode. To subscribe to this podcast, simply open your favorite podcast software and search for Contrarian Investor. Follow us on social media by searching for Contrarian Investor on Twitter and Instagram. Send us your thoughts on feedback@contrarianpod.com. We look forward to speaking to you again next time.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first 3 boards for free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.